Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Bud Mishkin, and this is On Point. What's the first question you ask when you learn someone has a newborn? You ask if it's a boy or a girl, right? Well, what if the parents wouldn't tell you because they don't want you or anyone else to impose gender stereotypes on their child? And what if they told you that they want the child to choose his or her gender when it gets older? It might sound radical, but a growing number of parents across the country are taking on the challenge. This hour on Point, raising babies. You can join us on air or online. Are you raising a baby? If not, what do you make of this parenting trend? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is Alex Morris, contributing editor for New York Magazine. You can find a link to her story, It's a Baby, at our website, onpointradio.org. Alex, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Bud. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. Alex, how did you come to this story?
So that's a great question. I started reporting the story. I was actually pregnant at the time. And when you're pregnant, people tend to give you lots of parenting advice, some, you know, some useful, some not. But someone at some point mentioned to me that they knew a couple who were raising a baby. They were not assigning a gender to the baby. It went by they, them pronouns, and they were going to let the child tell them what gender it was when it was old enough to do so. And to be entirely honest with you, I felt that this was very extreme when I heard about it. I was like, that's pretty crazy. But I was intrigued. I write a lot about gender, sex, and sexuality, which are obviously three different things. And like I said, I was pregnant at the time, so definitely my curiosity was piqued. And I started looking into it and realized that it was a very small movement, but a growing movement of parents doing this. And I definitely also became more intrigued by the philosophy behind it.
When you started investigating for the story, what did you learn about the reasoning behind the parents' decision to do it right from birth, as opposed to trying to do something once the child was 3 or 4 or 5 years old?
Sure. So the idea is that we're very socialized by gender. It is, besides a family's wealth, probably the most important determining factor for a child. And these parents, and obviously with the Me Too movement and everything that's happened in recently, these parents were very concerned about early socialization. This idea that even with the best of intentions, we put gender markers on kids. We treat them a certain way based on those gender markers. And the feeling was if you could some way stop this at the source, then there would be reverberating effects throughout that child's life. Now, generally, children will gender identify by the time they're about 3, preschool age. So the idea is not to have a kid that is free of gender. The idea is to let the child come to their understanding of gender in a sort of really sort of in as much of a vacuum as you can create so that their experience of gender is authentic to them.
What kind of response, Alex, what kind of response did your article get?
It got a lot of response. This was a really polarizing issue. Even within my peer group of liberal New Yorkers, there were people who were very adamantly opposed to the idea of raising a child this way. And then there are people who were like, wow, I wish I'd known about that. I would have done that. People weren't wishy-washy about it, which I think is true of most parenting techniques. These tend to be polarizing issues.
You talk about the people in your article, I believe, from Brooklyn. The original story, I believe, was from 2011 in Toronto. We'll have a guest in a couple of minutes from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Is there any notion that this is happening in any other countries?
Yes, yes. If you go to Instagram and put in hashtag gender creative or gender open, there are people actually all over the world doing this. Tokyo, Louisiana. I mean, actually the people doing it in, you know, sort of smaller towns in America really surprised me, but that's happening. It's not just New York and San Francisco.
So that's interesting. So the notion that, yeah, it's just not in certain communities is not the case?
Well, certainly parents who choose to do this are coming into it with, I would say, a pretty set beliefs about gender being a binary, or not a binary, a spectrum rather than a binary. These parents obviously tend to be pretty liberal. It's a lot of work raising a gender open baby. You have to be really careful about the preschools you select. Parents would write letters to all of the preschool classmates saying, this is what we're doing, this is why we're doing it. To the caregivers, you're going to be changing our child's diaper, but please don't tell anyone what the anatomy is. This idea that if no one knows a gender for your child, they can't stereotype them in any way.
Mm-hmm. Alex Morris is a contributing editor for the New York Magazine. Alex, we thank you for joining us today on Point. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Joining me now in studio is Nate Sharp. He is the father of 3-year-old twins, Zyler and Caden, who are being raised as babies. Nate, welcome to On Point. Thank you for coming in.
My pleasure.
So your story, what's the origin of your story and your decision?
So my wife, Julia, was pregnant. And as Alex mentioned, when you're pregnant or expecting children, you get all sorts of advice and questions. And people kind of follow this social script, as they do in pretty much any scenario, where they see somebody and they kind of react without thinking. And one of the questions in the social script that you ask somebody who's pregnant is, oh, what are you having? And then we would answer with twins. And then the question becomes even longer regarding their sex. Of it's not just are they boys or girls. It's, oh, are they boys, girls, one of each, at which point we're kind of thinking ahead and thinking, oh, we're not going to find out. And so initially my wife said, oh, yeah, I don't want to find out at the 20-week anatomy scan. And I said, we're going to find out eventually. What's the harm? I feel like there's no benefit to waiting. And so she went off and did some research and found some articles and some research papers and said, well, there are these gender stereotypes that mothers and parents and people are pushing on their kids. So one kind of striking example is that a study showed that mothers systematically underestimate their female children's crawling abilities at 6 months and systematically overestimate their male children's crawling abilities. There's no factual difference between the crawling abilities depending on sex. And so that really struck home with me of, the longer that we can delay ourselves kind of forming these preconceived notions of who our kids are going to be and what they're going to be good at, the better. So then we dealt with a few months of people asking us saying we're not going to find out, and people being shocked or amazed or like, I could never prepare. How are you going to do this? And it's like, well, we read the infant care instruction manual, and actually there's no difference in how you make sure that they're safe and healthy, other than maybe caring for their genitals, which is a minor part of raising a child.
Got to feed them, got to clean them up.
Exactly. And so we dealt with that for a few months, and then kind of jokingly a few weeks before the kids were born, we were talking with friends, and I was like, man, if people are pissed that we're not telling them now, what if we never told them? And then everybody laughed, and I was like, wait a second. Could we do that? And so then we researched it some more. We found some books that people were, in fact, doing this and kind of thought about it more and then decided, yep, we're going to do this thing, and went from there.
Did one of you have to bring the other kind of over the goal line, or were you both kind of even?
At that point, we were pretty in sync, we have pretty good communication. There were some times where, for instance, like in the first month after the kids were born, we were up at 3 a.m. after a feeding session, and one of us had slipped up and used a gendered pronoun, and we were like, we're so tired. Is it really important that at 3 a.m. when it's just us that we do this? And we like looked at each other and we thought for a while and we were like, I think it probably is, because if we don't practice it all the time, then we're going to slip up in public. And it's not just about doing it in public. It's about ourselves checking in all the time and reminding ourselves, you don't know who this person is going to be, and it's really not important right now. But what's important is those sleeping babies in your arm and kind of be present and with them right now.
Speaking of 3 a.m., are there moments where the babies are asleep, but you're awake and wondering at 3 a.m., am I doing the right thing?
Honestly, at this point, no, not really. No more than, I mean, I think I wonder more about like random times when somebody like took their oatmeal that I had just made them and looked at me in the eye and then turned it upside down and threw it on the floor and I raised my voice. And then at 3 a.m., I'm like, I could have handled that better. I know spilling food on the floor is a trigger for me, so I just got to work on that. I'm more worried about random times where I feel like I've failed differently in parenting than about this.
So you're talking about one of the kids did this?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. For a second, I thought perhaps someone else who, in response to what you were doing.
But no, this is like Zyler at like 1.5. It's just like, there's the oatmeal. Look at that. It's on the floor.
So at that moment, doesn't matter which pronoun you're using.
Right. Yeah.
Can you start to tell us some of the reactions that you've gotten?
So it's been a process. So when the kids were born, we sent out an announcement and didn't reveal their gender. And honestly, a lot of people didn't kind of notice. We didn't make an explicit thing in our little email to friends and family. When people ask and you have babies in the airport or at a restaurant or whatever, they ask, and 95% of the time we'd say, oh, we're raising them gender neutral until they're old enough to identify. And they would kind of get surprised, realize that they didn't care, and then be like, and would you like fries with that? Because they're just following a social script. They're like, baby, ask this question.
Right.
Oh, wait, I don't care. Okay. And so that's like 95%. The other 5% were like, I don't know, 90% of that 5% were support. Oh, that's cool. That's interesting. Kind of 5% were like, what do you mean? But I mean their sex. Can you tell me their sex? Oh, no, we can't do that.
We'll get to more stories in our next segment. Parents concealing the sex of their babies so that the children, often called babies, can choose their own gender. I'm Bud Mishkin. This is On Point.
Hi, I'm Shankar Vedantam, host of the podcast Hidden Brain. This summer, we're sharing a series about reinventing yourself. We call it You 2.0. Add us to your summer listening for ideas about responding to life's messiness and chaos with wisdom.
This is On Point. I'm Bud Mishkin. We're talking about babies, children who are raised without gender designations until they're old enough to choose one for themselves. You can join the conversation. Is allowing kids to choose their own gender giving a toddler too much autonomy? Does raising a baby put an unfair burden on everyone else in the child's life? Does that matter? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking with Nate Sharp, the father of baby twins Caden and Zyler. Last Friday, Fox News host Tucker Carlson questioned parents who let their children decide their gender at a young age.
What other profound life decisions do we think people ought to be making at the age of 4? Are there any others?
Well,
whether to get a tattoo, whether to get married, enlisting in the military, voting, drinking vodka, smoking Marlboro Reds. Is there anything else that we think 4-year-olds are ready to decide?
Now, you know you're going to have to deal, when you make this decision, I would imagine, with the Tucker Carlsons of the world in terms of shouting and having an opinion. People who have an opinion who don't even know you, that's part of the world we live in right now. But let's shove all that aside. People who love you, okay? Any examples? Name's not necessary, of course. People who love you came to you and say, I got it. I know you're, of course, trying to do the best things for your kids. You love your kids. We love you. But I just don't understand. I just don't get it.
We had some questions just for clarification, but we've honestly been hugely lucky that pretty much across the board, 100% of our family and loved ones have been supportive. There's been confusion at first and questions, but we laid out the research, et cetera, gave them reading materials, kind of shorter to longer books, paragraphs, posts, and pretty much everybody is on board. We've had zero real kind of vehement pushback from our loved ones, which not everybody is as lucky as us in that respect.
Hmm. And you know that from people who have told you stories?
Or? Yeah. We're on a Facebook group that is for parents doing this sort of thing. And a lot of people are like, yeah, I don't talk to my parents anymore because they were just not on board in a really kind of belligerent way.
Right. We have plenty of calls on the lines. Let's get to them. Mimi is calling from Greenville, Tennessee. Mimi, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Bud. My comment is I love the idea, and I actually just heard about it, 15 minutes ago when you guys started the show. I have a 4.5-year-old daughter and an 18-month-old, and they're both girls, and we read a lot of books, and I find myself every evening changing the pronouns, and it drives my husband crazy, but he's fine with it because I would say about 80% of our books have male leads, and I never really thought of it until I saw my daughter playing with her stuffed animals and her dolls, and they were all male. She'd refer to, her toys with the male, so I think it's a great idea. My 4.5-year-old already knows she's a girl, excuse me, but my 18-month old, I don't know if it's too late, but I like the idea.
Mimi, thanks for the phone call. Thank you for calling On Point. Ron is now calling from Towson, Maryland. Ron, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Bud. Thank you very much for taking my call. A great topic, as always. And this one, I kind of feel a personal connection to. My wife wanted to raise our son relatively gender neutral. We did not do the due diligence that your guest did. But we found out early on that at least with him, anecdotal, of course, at least with him, it wasn't going to fly. He wanted the moving vehicles. He didn't want anything like dolls and things like that. He was your stereotypical boy. I love the idea of it, but I have to say I taught a course. I'm a speech-language pathologist. I taught a course called Sociolinguistics, where we actually explored society use gender and how society does impose gender to a degree. However, there's a great film I recommend, don't know if you can find it, called Why Men Don't Iron. It's from England. And the science seems very solid, but it is older. But the science seemed very solid and made very clear cases. The anecdote that I told you about my son, it's actually typical, is that we really are wired differently. I'm totally open to the science has found something different now and really engaged in the idea of following this gentleman if the information look and seeing how it works with his kids. That's my take on it.
Ron, thanks for the call. Annette, you want to respond?
So we're not denying that people are different and that if you look at humanity as a whole, there you can kind of classify the majority of people into two sexes. Now that's the majority. There are a real number of people who are intersex, both in terms of variations in their external genitalia, internal gonads, chromosomal makeup, et cetera. And that's not even touching on the actual subject of gender as it's defined today. And I think that the benefit of this approach is that if you're doing it right, then it's totally fine for your kid to kind of play with those stereotypical toys. But then when they do, you can be comfortable in the knowledge that they do it because they really like it and not because they're trying to fit into a group that you've placed them in.
That's been put upon them.
Right.
Right. From Twitter, Elizabeth writes, the more important factor is not to force children to behave in a gender-conforming way, but to give them the room to just be themselves. Over time, I believe that we will recognize that gender, like biological sex, is really more of a continuum rather than a binary. I'd like to bring another voice in now. Joining us now from Friday Harbor, Washington, via Skype, is Lise Elliott. Lise is a professor of neuroscience at the Chicago Medical School at Rosalind Franklin University of Medicine and Science. She's also the author of the book Pink Brain, Blue Brain, How Small Differences Grow into Troublesome Gaps and What We Can Do About It. Lise, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Bud. Good to be here.
So what is your take on this and the whole notion of babies?
Well, I think that Nate has articulated it very well. Boys and girls are not identical at birth, although I have to say that thus far we really can't pinpoint any dramatic differences in their brains at all. Even in adult men and women, the differences are turning out to be very, very subtle. And you really, even though we talk about a male brain and a female brain, it really is much more unisex. It's more like the difference between a male heart and a female heart, which, of course, we can transplant between people. So gender is very much of a spectrum, and really that is different from sex. Sex is much more binary than gender is. The attributes we consider gender, you know, how aggressive someone is, how empathetic, how good in language and math and so on, all of these traits are smeared across a spectrum, and a single male or female really is very difficult to pinpoint on any one of those abilities. So, you know, I think giving children the freedom is really a very admirable experiment, and I know it's challenging, but we all try to do this. Some of us try to do this to different degrees, and I really admire Nate and Julia for their attempt.
From Twitter, Sylvia Guerra writes, "The concept of raising children free from the constraints of gender is great, but using the term babies does nothing more than incense and alienate conservatives and keep them from taking this seriously." Nate, why babies, and what is there something in particular? No, being a wise guy here, is there something in particular that's wrong with the word babies, and does it already bring with it something inherent that you wanted to avoid?
So I don't know who coined that term. We only kind of came across it with Alex's article. And so language is constantly changing and evolving, and you're not going to be able to control how other people understand the language that you use. And so we could, instead of saying babies, go on a long, you know, 20-minute dissertation about every detail of what we're doing, but it's going to be incomplete no matter what. So we didn't coin the term. We generally don't actually use it in interpersonal conversation at all because, again, most people either don't know what it means or are going to misconstrue it.
Right.
So we just kind of answer people's questions at the level that they're asking it.
Let's go back to your phone calls now on Point. Erin is calling from Burlington, Vermont. Erin, thanks for joining us on On Point.
Hi, Bud. Yeah, I actually just had the same comment as the Twitter response that I'm really excited to see more people using they and them in their everyday lives. And even with my brother's child, I try to stop from socializing them to the gender norms that I think they are perceived to be and are identified with. But again, baby kind of brings about this designer baby tone that definitely I have already seen on social media. Has definitely scared off and been used to mock liberal social norms on my social media. So again, just finding other terms that can help people be more open to gender-neutral child rearing.
Erin, thank you for the call. Let's go to Richard now, calling from Boca Raton, Florida. Richard, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Bud. Thanks for taking my call. So it's an interesting idea. I wonder if the parents have thought about what effect this will have on their children's peers as they start to get into school. Children can be pretty brutal and hateful in school, especially when somebody is different or awkward. So I wonder what their thoughts are on that. Thank you.
Nate, why don't you dive in on that?
Absolutely. So definitely bullying is a real risk with any kid. I think that every person has kind of a total risk for bullying, right? And that's the result of many different risk factors and protective factors. And definitely being gender nonconforming is a risk factor, as is being low socioeconomic status, having a mental disability, playing more than 3 hours of video games a day. There's a whole slew of them. And then protective factors, our kids actually have many of them. And so we personally, after doing a lot of research and thinking about it, have come to the conclusion that while it helps to be prepared for that eventuality through good communication and support of our kids, which I think most people would agree is a good thing to strive for regardless, the net positive outweighs the negative, because there are real negatives associated with gendering your children. The numbers vary, but the lowest estimate of the number of trans people in the world is something like 0.3%. Now, a lot of people say, oh, like, that's so small, you might as well not worry about it. Well, the lower numbers of estimates of trans people attempting suicide is around 25% and as high as 60%. So you multiply those two lower bounds together and you get an odds of about 1 in 130,000 that your kid, no matter who they are, is trans and attempts suicide at some point in their life. Now, you might say, 1 in 130,000, why do I need to worry about that? Well, that's about the same risk as your child dying from fire or smoke inhalation. Do you have smoke detectors in your home? Do you teach your kids about stop, drop, and roll and not to play with fire? It's about the same risk as your child drowning and dying in the water. Do you give your kid floaties and try to teach them how to swim and be safe around water? It's even three times as likely as your child dying from choking. Now, I know a lot of people have freaked out when their kids are eating something and choke, but it's so unlikely. It's three times less likely than that they're trans and attempt suicide. So there are real risks associated with kind of the traditional gendered way of raising kids. And after doing that huge multifactorial cost-benefit analysis, we came to the conclusion that the minor risks from bullying kind of came out in the wash, and that on the whole, it was a positive choice. And that's why we're doing it.
Let's add another voice to the conversation. Joining us now from Boston is Eugene Baresson. Eugene is a child and adolescent psychiatrist and executive director of the Clay Center for Young Healthy Minds at Massachusetts General Hospital. Gene, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Bud.
So give us your take on this whole discussion and the issue of babies.
Sure. Well, first of all, I want to applaud the sensitivity, the planning, the thoughtfulness of Nate, Julia, and Alex in making this decision. I think that it's an admirable social mission to kind of change sexual stereotypes and pigeonholing our boys and girls. I think we've come a long way since the 1970s, where girls have been able to be more assertive and competitive, and the advent of Title IX has been huge, and boys have been more empathic and able to actually cry and hug each other after sporting events. And I think this is a step in the right direction. That being said, you know, as parents, it's our job to support our children, to know who they are, to have conversations with them, to be open-minded and not judgmental, and also to, you know, we make decisions in parenting across the board that embraces our choices, values, and beliefs as parents. And as Nate was pointing out, you know, there are risks to this. It may not be for everyone. The risks of a kid being assigned a non-gender pronoun comes with consequences. And as Nate pointed out, it is the risk of bullying. The Gay and Lesbian and Straight Educational Network has done extensive research on this, and non-conforming gendered youth are about twice the risk of bullying. Bullying, in some cases, can scar a kid for life, and one-third of kids are bullied, and these kids can be, you know, marginalized, bullied, confused, scared, and stressed. Now, the job of parents, of course, as Nate is doing, is to monitor your kids, to watch them, to make corrections, to help them navigate these waters. And if it needs self-correcting, we as parents, you know, can self-correct, and that's what our job is. So I think they're going about this social experiment in a thoughtful manner, aware of the risks with eyes wide open. And I'm curious, because there is no research on how these children will turn out, so we're, you know, looking at this now. I'm curious to see how it comes out, and you know, I wish them the best.
Gene, in a 2011 ABC News article, you were quoted as saying, to raise a child not as a boy or girl is creating, in some sense, a freak. It sets them up for not knowing who they are. Let's make the assumption that that's a correct quote, or that you were not improperly quoted. Has your thought on the subject, has there been any nuance in your thought on the subject since 2011?
It actually is an incorrect quote, because when it was about the child Storm, who was raised in Toronto in a homogeneous community, and my comment was, this may be fine, you know, just as Nate has carefully chosen the school, the community, the folks that the kids are going to be seeing. My comment, the context of the comment was, take Storm out of that community and put that child in a different community, and the child could be viewed as a freak and marginalized.
Got it.
That's the danger. The danger is that we want our kids to know who they are and to be tolerant and open-minded and flexible, but also to be able to...
Gene, I'm going to cut in for a second. We got to go to a break. Gene, Nate, Lise, stand by. We're discussing a trend in creative parenting world, raising babies. I'm Bud Mishkin. This is On Point.
There's a new way to hear Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and all your favorite programs. Just ask your smart device to play NPR. Listen to your local station anytime, like this. Hey, smart device, play NPR.
This is On Point. I'm Bud Mishkin. Our topic today is parents who conceal the sex of their children so that the child can choose his own gender down the line. You can join the conversation. Do you think male and female children are inherently different? If so, should it matter, then, if they're raised without a gender designation? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest today in studio, Nate Sharp, the father of baby twins, Zyler and Caden. Lise Elliott is the professor of neuroscience at the Chicago Medical School at Rosalind Franklin University of Medicine and Science. And Jean Baresson, a child and adolescent psychiatrist. Let's go back to your phone calls, of which we have plenty. Christina is calling from Richmond, Virginia. Christina, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Bud. I think that this is a very interesting and engaging idea, one that I'm not opposed to, but one that has an edge of privilege that I don't think has been addressed yet. And so what I've been thinking about are how there are visible and invisible identities. And as a Black woman, my Blackness is something that has been visible since birth and kind of goes hand in hand with like historical and cultural ways that I navigate the world, and the world has also treated me. And so if we're going to talk about gender-neutral upbringing, I think we need to also take into account how the intersectionality of race and other identities kind of intersect with gender. And then my other point is also, as a Black woman, honest conversations were had with me by my parents about what race is and the historical implications and the way that society would try and limit or propel me because of my race. And I guess I'm questioning or don't quite understand why these kind of conversations, like these honest, continuous conversations throughout a child's upbringing about the implications of sex and the historical implications of gender couldn't be had.
Christina, thank you for your phone call. Lise and Jean, I'm going to forward that to you. Lise, we'll start with you. In your research, anything in terms of that intersectionality of race and gender neutrality?
Well, I think that's a fantastic point that you can hide gender to a point, especially in prepubescent kids. There's very, very little difference. It's all mostly in the haircut and the clothes that we decode gender, whereas you cannot do that with racial identity. But I think another issue we really need to talk about, and it does inform both the way we react to people's race and gender, is the issue of unconscious bias. So, you know, as much, I'm sure Nate and Julia have thought about this, given how knowledgeable they are on the topic, but as much as we explicitly can adjust our behavior in order to be, you know, as fair and equal to individuals as possible, we have a lot of automatic reactions to people based on our knowledge of their sex or gender or race. And so I'm curious, actually, to sort of throw the question back at Nate and wonder, you know, if they sense any that their conscious knowledge of their baby's gender is influencing their behavior at all, because we so much of our behavior is at the subconscious, quick level that we don't have time to consciously process.
Yeah, that's a great point, Lise. And to that point, I think you had made it earlier of if people don't know, then they can't unconsciously bias our kids. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. we have changed their diapers and take care of them as any normal parents. And so we do know. And I think that's where the language actually is super helpful and important, because it is hard to change your language. The use of gendered pronouns is so ingrained in everybody. And that gives us this kind of very frequent reminder to check ourselves and to kind of make sure that we're not, or try harder not to unconsciously have those biases influence our actions and decisions. That's actually gotten less true as we've gotten more comfortable with it and kind of don't notice it. But the kind of constant conversations with other people asking about it, talking about it as it kind of grows in visibility is kind of this constant reminder for us to check in with ourselves to make sure, or try harder not to do that.
Let's go back to your phone calls now. Andrea is calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Andrea, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Bud. Thank you. Hi.
Go ahead, Andrea. You're on.
Yes, thank you. So I am really excited about this idea of raising the children gender neutral. And I think even if there are some difficulties, maybe for these children initially or other children who are early in the cultural evolution of this trend, that in the long run, it has a lot of implications for reducing stigma. And I think even for reducing stigma for people who might be involved in so-called same-sex relationships, because if the gender is not defined, then their relationship is also not going to be defined as a certain type of relationship.
Andrea, thank you for your call today to On Point. Let's move on. We have plenty more calls. Allie is calling from Toronto, Canada. Allie, welcome to On Point.
Hello, everyone. Oh, my goodness gracious. I am so happy about this episode of radio. I am a 45-year-old non-binary transgender person. Holy cow. So thank you so much for making this episode. Any ease and effort made to understanding who we are is so appreciated. I think for me, the thing that I find missing most from these conversations is having people on or chat with actual trans and non-binary people to learn more about us and who we are. Otherwise, it's cisgender folks deciding our fates without actually being super educated on the experiences themselves. For me, I feel the main thing here that's jumping out for me, language is so important. So when I'm hearing from a lot of people who are not educated on these topics, they'll use the word gender across the board when still learning the word, the difference between gender and sex, which are totally two different things. So I find that using the term sex assigned at birth and gender are two very good little pieces of language to kind of help us differentiate before those between those things. Changing language for me is really important. Growing up as a little kid who never really felt comfortable as female or male, I always felt isolated when I would have a class being addressed as girls or ladies and gentlemen. I'm trying to help people use things like everybody, friends, pals, folks, just super inclusive. Better way to change your language around pronouns as well. It's just not a big deal. We just have to think of it that way.
Allie, thank you for your phone call. Thanks for your phone call today to On Point. Gene, let's get you back in the conversation. Yeah. As a psychiatrist, we've mentioned previously in this hour about this is a relatively new thing, and there's really not evidence of what it means for the child when the child is 10, when the child is 15. Is there a particular period that people in science look at, a particular period of time, and say, okay, after this amount of time, we'll be able to have enough data to do some serious research on the effect of babies?
Well, I think it's a moving target. We know that the vast majority of kids will identify themselves as in the gender-specific way by age 3 to 4. But the process of identity actually continues throughout childhood and adolescence. And in fact, in adolescence, there's, as Erickson pointed out, it's a stage of identity versus identity confusion. Teenagers will often question their values, their beliefs, how they're identified, whom they're affiliated with, and it's a crisis in development, but it's a growing point in development. It will be really interesting to follow these kids for a long time. I'm not sure that the gender neutrality at ages 3 and 4, and then if one of Nate's kids, for example, determines that he or she is a he or she or a they at 4, whether that will have an impact on the beliefs about sex role stereotypes, about what it is to be male or female, how it affects their sexual preference, how it affects other parts of their identity. The most important thing to me is, as this last caller said, we need to hear more stories. We need to hear more narratives of how people have developed in various different ways over time in terms of gender, race, spirituality, affiliation, group identity, and so we get a sense of it. We just don't talk enough about it, and the more conversations we can have with our kids and with our peers and families and communities, the better we're all going to be.
The debate about they-bes has led to fierce arguments across the political spectrum. In that sense, the subject of they-bes is certainly not alone, because rare is the subject these days that does not lead to fierce arguments across the political spectrum. In 2011, ABC's show The View took on the issue.
It troubles me that this seems to be some sort of social experiment where they're using their child to send a message to everybody else. I think that's selfish. I think that you...
But if you put a dress on a boy, and he's a boy, and he's a heterosexual boy, whatever, he's going to be a boy no matter what you put on him.
But I don't think they're saying that they are going to do that. I think they're saying she will know or he will know what he is, and he will decide from there on what he's going to do. But I get it.
When you were starting this, Nate, and you look across the table at your wife over dinner or lying in bed late at night, is there some notion of we're in this, and if we're going to do this, this is not something that we're just going to have to deal with today or tomorrow. We're going to have to encounter people with opinions who know nothing of us for a long time to come?
Not a whole lot at first. We were pretty private about it, and just talking to the people that we were talking to, and to the social experiment point, I don't think anybody that I've heard of that is doing this, ourselves included, is trying to send a message to other people, and they're just doing it because they think it's the best thing for their kids.
Mm-hmm. And I don't want to presume what kind of reactions you get. You've told us a little bit about it, but is there any notion of when you travel, for example, and leave your home in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and go somewhere else, is that ever a consideration? Like, what will people in that town, that part of the country, think about this?
Yeah, it's mostly kind of, like I said, the social script of people just kind of realize that they don't care and then move on. We've gotten maybe like one or two people who are like, no, but I just mean the sex. And then we're like, but yeah, we're not going to tell you about their genitals. And it's a little weird that you're asking. We haven't gotten any really to our face vehement, belligerent comments, which is great. And as a previous caller mentioned, kind of a sign of our privilege of where we live, mm-hmm. and our support network and our families.
And response from peer group, friends?
Has been totally supportive and respectful, yeah.
Let's try and get one more call in before we finish up the segment. Ted is calling, I believe, from Miami, Florida. Ted, welcome to On Point.
Hi, bud. Interesting conversation. I'm just worried that we're overthinking everything. I respect any parent that's raising their children the way they want to. I guess I was worried. I'm raising two little girls, and I've enjoyed, you know, the pinks and the dolls and everything. But I agree that I introduced them to boys' things. I guess I'm worried they're sponges. So if I try to tell these little girls about transgender issues, are they going to absorb that and want to be?
Ted, I think we called you there. I think we lost you there. Sorry about that. Let's get one more comment in from Twitter. Gary Corden writes, gender roles have existed since the beginning of time. There is a huge physical difference between the sexes. I believe it to be disingenuous to deny that. Nate, one last thing for you, and that is, at the end of the day, people who love you, friends of yours, have you had the occasion for people to say, I got it, I'm going to do the best I can, but really, have you gotten that response, or is it, without those people, not bad people?
Yep.
You know, no judgment there.
We've gotten different levels of buy-in and practicing the pronouns, et cetera, but really across the board, at least to our faces, everybody has been totally respectful and falls along with our wishes.
Lise, we'll give you a final word. Where do you think this goes from here?
Well, you know, I'm actually a biologist and study animals in my earlier career. And, you know, we really have to, I think the whole transgender movement, as well as the effort to raise gender-free children, really does reinforce this idea that gender is a human construct. It is built out of our language and culture, and it is not a built-in part of our biology. It's correlated with it, but animals don't have gender. Only humans have gender, and we are getting increasingly creative about it.
Gene, a final word from you.
Yes. Well, I think it's a moving target. But I think that we need to be aware that, you know, one of the focuses that I'd like to end with, we talked a lot with Nate about the parent experience. I'm concerned about the child experience and how the kids are metabolizing this movement. What is the impact on the child? How does it affect the child's self-esteem? How does the child affect the child's relationship with others? And let's watch out for the kids, because that's our main mission. I value what the parents feel and believe, but I think we have to be concerned about the impact on the kids and see what the trajectory is going to be for their futures.
We've had so many comments on Twitter, on Facebook, on the phone today. Another comment from Twitter, Rachel Watts writes, at what age do you think people should make a decision about physical changes? Some kids begin taking hormones and have surgery in their teens, and I wonder, is that wise? Studies show the brain doesn't finish developing until your early 20s. And one final comment from Twitter, from Hammerman, actually from the website, and when exactly should these poor kids decide what gender they will be? I think we've addressed that. And what if gender requires some training and indoctrination, and absent that, they become lost in the middle? The subject has been babies. Anyone, any parent obviously wants their kid to grow up, be happy, be fulfilled, and any parent will try and do whatever the parent can in order to make that happen. And so I appreciate anyone who is going against the grain, for whatever that term means, and try to make that happen. So, Nate, good luck to you.
Thanks.
Nate Sharp is the father of 3-year-old baby twins, Zyler and Caden. Nate, thank you so much for coming in studio today.
My pleasure.
Lise Elliott is a professor of neuroscience at the Chicago Medical School at Rosalind Franklin University of Medicine and Science. Thank you, Lise.
My pleasure.
And Gene Bereson is a child and adolescent psychiatrist and the executive director of the Clay Center for Young Healthy Minds at Massachusetts General Hospital. Gene, thank you.
Thank you very much.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poley, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, Miriam Wasser, our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Bud Mishkin. This is On Point.